Okay, well, without any further ado, so we can get on with it, we have Jim Geddes talking about the design of the OLPC. So, thank you, Jim.
Thank you. Most of you don't get a chance to see how sausage is ground, which is to say, you don't get to actually work on building systems. So I'm going to try to give you some feeling for how this thing came into existence. It's actually quite different than most other laptops, and I think you'll find that interesting. The first thing, however, is you have to understand the purpose of all of this. So I want to go into a little bit into our mission, then obviously what we've done in the way of the design, which is quite unusual in a bunch of ways, a little bit about software, and if we have any time left over, Q&A. One thing you have to understand about designing hardware is that if the parts don't exist in the quantity you need, you just can't build it. It's fundamentally different from software, which tends to be more malleable. So for example, I was hoping to have a pallet of machines to hand out at this conference, but the touchpad was giving us fits, and so the second build slipped, and Dave Woodhouse and I go to Shanghai on Sunday to nurse the second build of machines. You got to get every last little part. Some of the parts can be substituted, but not others. There's obviously some finite number of possible ingredients in the world, but you know, if you know a farmer someplace, you might be able to get some new stuff grown for you. But some of it takes more than a few months. Some of it takes several years, like if you want a new version of a processor. Volume speaks. If you make a lot of sausage, you can often get things made the way you, new ingredients made for you. In our case, we've had a couple things made for us, despite being sort of a new kid on the block. I'll go into what those were. But a lot of major ingredients take years to grow rather than a season. And so for those of you who work for hardware vendors, you might want to take some notes because there are things that I wish worked very differently and much better on future hardware. So this is somewhat trying to tell people what I'd like to have for the future as well. Hardware design isn't a pretty process, neither is software for that matter. And you really have to actually put it together before you really get a full taste of what it's going to be like. So for us, what we're really about is education. Education of the world's children. That's our mission, okay? And that has some truly unique constraints that make current laptops pretty useless. So who we're trying to serve is the somewhere between 1 and 1.5 billion school age kids in primarily in the developing world, because that's where most of them are. So that's, and most kids, by the way, get only 5 or 6 years of education. So we're actually talking about young kids, okay? Computers have mostly been applied for, say, middle school and high school kinds of things, and haven't really been addressing the kids we care about or care most about just by terms of numbers. This was taken a few months ago in the capital city of Nigeria. This is a real school. This is a good school by those standards. Here's another school, I think somewhere else in Nigeria. I saw some wonderful pictures by Greg Mortensen of northern Pakistan. I wish I'd been able to get my hands on them because they were really spectacular. So from our point of view, the way things are is really the riskiest thing. So we're really worrying about it. The next very quick thing I want to mention is people have been doing kids in education for many years. This is Seymour Papert, who unfortunately was very seriously injured in Vietnam a few months ago. This is like 30 years ago. Those are Apple IIs you see there, or 20 or 30 years ago. So there have been pilots for years and years, but to really make this real, we have to make computers as much as pen and paper. They really need to be one laptop per child. The idea of shared labs means you might actually get 90 minutes a week or something. How much are you going to learn about computing in 90 minutes a week, or how much impact does that have? So it's really time to move on to doing this at real scale. This is a picture of some experiments that Nicholas Negroponte ran in a couple, actually still going on, in very rural Cambodia. He learned a lot from this experience, including the fact that the building the school was the cheap part. Conventional laptops were much more expensive than the rest of the infrastructure. So other interesting things he learned were things like when the kids took the machines home for the first time at night, and the first problem was getting the parents to let them use to actually use the computers. Then the next night, after they'd actually managed to tell everybody, yeah, we really want the kids to use the machines, they discovered that, oh, well, this is the first time that most of the kids have any artificial light after the sun goes down. So it gets used as a flashlight, among other things. So you'll find, for example, a couple of LEDs on our machine for lighting up the keyboard, and also because that's a more efficient way to have a flashlight. So these are the countries we're working with. There's color coding. The green ones are where we currently expect to deploy first, though all those are subject to change courtesy of things like coup d'etats and other fun things. So we shall see. All the experiments to date, the kids are just as bright everywhere in the world as they are here or in the United States, so long as they've had decent nutrition. They have equal, what they need is opportunity. They're capable. So we really need to start thinking about how to get computers and information into the kids at real scale. One thing to remember is that people to learn should be building things and doing things, very much the way we do. So they are not passive creators of passive recipients of content, as the media companies might like you to think, but also creators of content. It's very important. This is a mock-up of an application which is partially running now on a machine called PamPam, which is really a wonderful music application. We're very much of the mold of we want the kids to be able to do experiments and learn that way. So one of the things our audio port can do is do analog input rather than just AC input. So that's a 50-cent photodiode on the end of a wooden spoon that my cousin Miller Puckett put together. He originally did an experiment about conducting music like 20 years ago, and he recreated it for us spring on the original test board. That's the most recent incarnation of his baton for conducting music. The total cost is somewhere, the connector is probably the most expensive, but the total cost is about $1. People say, well, you know, why not a USB dongle? Well, they cost money. $1 solutions would be $10 to $50. Actually, if you can go to the web, you can find such devices, but they're very expensive. So. The other thing to understand is that the kids spend a lot of time, and if you have children, you watch your kids work with their friends all the time. They really learn a lot from each other in a big way. And so we consider it extremely important that collaboration and sharing of information is really inherent in the machines. Of course, to do that then begs how do we get the bits from point A to point B? How do the kids talk to each other in that sense? So our answer is there's a bunch of wireless technologies or satellite technologies. We'll use anything we can get, obviously. In some places, you'll find cell phone systems. Bandwidth is a perishable commodity, so in those cases, we were talking with the carriers about maybe the bandwidth they're not using should get used for the schools. And it also turns out that a lot of these are regulated monopolies that, shall we say, the government has some control over. This is, I think, someplace in Pakistan at one point. I don't remember where this was. Again, this is some experiments. This is crossing, connecting a couple of schools. One was in Kashmir and the other was in India or some such place. You know, across the red line of control there. It can also be used to connect people together. And of course, the hackers here know all about building networks. And as you know, point-to-point A2011 networks are by far the cheapest we can do right now just because of everything going. This is a picture from in downtown Athens of what somebody had put together. So we expect that to happen. The other thing we're doing, which is relatively new, is mesh networking. There are some mesh networks in existence, like MIT RoofNet, which covers a good chunk of Cambridge, Massachusetts, where the machines can forward packets for each other. So we don't need access points to provide connectivity. Okay? There's a standard under development called 802.11f. That's what we're trying to use. Obviously, we'll do it with what it takes to make it actually work. And then, of course, you go to this sort of mesh of meshes and how to connect them all together in various ways. And there are lots of ways to do that. Let's go start focusing really on the laptop in this case, grind some sausage. So we have to worry about making sure that if kids drop things, obviously it needs to be safe. So I don't want to see repetition of Alan Cox's flaming laptop. Light to carry, because a kid shouldn't be carrying around four or five kilos all the time, along with whatever else they have, just for computer. Kids like bright objects. It's got to be really low power. It turns out the operating expenses in a lot of schools that do have computers in remote locations right now, the largest single operating expense is things like diesel fuel for the generator. Not to mention, over half the kids in the world have no electricity at home. And there's a large chunk of schools which have no electricity, and even the ones that have electricity may not have reliable electricity and or have it in like one room in the whole school. You can't count on electric power. So we have to be able to use almost anything we can get in the way of power, including the ability for a kid to be able to generate the power themselves. So they can rely on the computer being available when they need it, just the way you do a piece of paper. If you can't do that, then we're doing something, you know, there's a real problem. The other observation is lots of kids are taught outdoors. There are not schools in many places. So we have to have a display which works in bright sunlight. And those of you who've ever tried it with your laptop, how many of you have ever succeeded in direct sunlight to use your laptop? Oh, I don't see a single hand. Oh, one person. Probably an old laptop rather than the current one. In any case, so obviously we have to make it as cheap as possible. Our first target's $100. The initial price of this machine looks like to be of order 140 or thereabouts, who knows. So we have some major challenges, that of power and connectivity. Obviously, it's also political uncertainty is also an interesting issue in a lot of places. So the physical environment's a real challenge. One of our initial countries is going to be Libya, which happens to, in southern Libya, have the hottest recorded temperature on the face of the planet. Not to mention dust, and then there's kids who are walking home from school who may get caught in a tropical downpour. So our machine needs to be really pretty robust. So things like disk drives just aren't going to make it. They fail on three grounds. They're too expensive, they're too fragile, and they eat too much power. Three strikes, you're out. Obviously, that says interesting things about our software. If your software is big and bloated, we got a problem with it because it will up the cost. So this is sort of an idea of where the cost would go if you play by the standard rules. And the display is a good chunk of it. Sales, marketing, and distribution is another huge chunk of it. In our case, we're going directly to governments to try to cut that out. And then the support of obese software, by which I mean you need lots of disk and lots of memory and that sort of stuff. I think Andy Tenenbaum had it correct this morning. So we're avoiding these problems. And the display itself is really novel, as I'll go into in some detail. To the point where it has lots of new things. So we really need to get down to a couple watts or less. On a typical laptop is, you know, somewhere up in the anywhere from 10 to 50 watts kind of range. Lots of people are carrying around power bricks that are up to 90 watt power bricks. This is sort of a non-starter. A small kid, might be able to generate between 5 and 10 watts. That's reality. That was an interesting eye-opening thing about a year ago when we understood that fully, because that drove very many of our designs. So a machine that just consumes even 2.5 to 3.5 watts, say, is too much. That would be saying that a lot of small kids would have to be generating a third of the time or something. So we have to somehow get the power well down from that. The other observation was, if we want the mesh network to work in parts of the world which do not have power, we need to have the mesh network alive all the time. And if you've got 21 watt-hour batteries and the machine minimum power is 2 or 3 watts, how many hours does that get you? What do you think the kid's going to try to do so they have power when they need it, particularly if it's that much work to generate more power? They will try to disable the wireless, okay, or turn off the machine, which completely to do so. So we had to worry about that. So we, so unless the kid's confident they'll be power when they need it, they're going to try to disable the wireless by turning off the machine, fundamentally. But I'll note that on most machines, the CPU is just refreshing the screen, which takes way too much power. Typical screens like 6 or 8 watts or more, or forwarding packets. So what do we do about it? So we're going to be in the process of getting going, but we don't have this running quite yet, is to turn off the CPU in most of the system whenever we can. And we can leave the wireless on, courtesy of the wireless chip we use, and also the display. So you can sit there and read a book at very low power levels indeed, because the processor can be powered off while doing that, the main CPU, most of the main CPU board. So we're using a wireless chip made by Marvell, for which we do not know of any equivalents right now, which happens to have a nice little ARM outboard engine, CPU, very low power, and if I remember correctly, 192 kilobytes of RAM. So we think we'll be down in the, depending upon whether you're running with the backlight on, half a watt to 1.5 watts, that sort of thing. So we should have pretty good life. When all that's happening is forwarding packets, this Marvell chip has been measured at about 300 milliwatts. So 300 milliwatts into 21 watt hours, well, you know, you do the arithmetic, that's a long time. So we start to have some hope that maybe the kids will leave their machine to benefit the other kids nearby by leaving their machine on forwarding packets. So there's good, bad, and ugly about all of this. Turning the CPU off gets to our power consumption. What's called the decon chip we built in the Marvell wireless that make this work. But it turns out that the CPU we do isn't very swift about getting going when you turn it on. It takes about 25 milliseconds. I clocked a 200 megahertz IPAC, which sits there and does nothing absolutely for something approaching half a second, which is something dumb about its power supply. But from the time it comes out of reset to when Linux is actually scheduling processes, I've asked this trick question on enough occasions now, I don't mind blowing the cover. Everybody gets the wrong answer. It's about 10 milliseconds. That's a 200 megahertz strong arm. So it ought to be really, really fast. The Geo is pretty slow to get its PLL stable. And we're not doing anything stupid about our power supply. So this is perceptible, but it's not horrible. It's just that don't want to turn off the CPU between each keystroke if you're typing quickly, but we can turn off the CPU much of the time. We're also going to play some other tricks which aren't all that novel. There are other people doing this sort of stuff. I think I've already touched on this pretty much. As you may have noticed, these guys have real antennas. This makes a really significant difference on your wireless range. James Cameron has done some wonderful work that he talked about today, where he's gone up to 1.3 kilometers with two of these machines talking to each other, line of sight. He doesn't know how far yet, how far he can potentially go. That's without a unidirectional antenna. That's in the outback, which is obviously sort of the extreme radio quiet case, but that sort of thing. So these are sort of a guess of where we think our power consumption will come in, as you know, we've sort of added up what it ought to be, and hopefully we'll get here soon. So this is, there is no such thing as a free lunch. We really is our highest priority, and it's driven a lot of our hardware stuff, and we're now working on getting the software running. I think Matthew Garrett posted for us a nice little restarting patch on how to do this, this for it. So in any case, we had to worry a lot about how to make it cheap. So that, of course, volume is really critical. You can't get a reasonable price on anything custom unless you're making things in quantity millions, because guess what? It takes a order $1.5 million to make have an ASIC made. Okay. Well, the non-recoverable engineering cost is a lot, right? It's $1.5 million to get the first chip. The next, 3,000 chips cost nothing effectively. One lot of things. So you really have to have volume. So that's a premise of this project, is to get a lot of things. So we're using an AMD Geode. It's not, it's sort of the lowest power x86 thing right now that has semi-reasonable performance, though most of the geeks in this room wouldn't call it a fast machine. It has the feature, from our point of view, the issue with most of the other architectures isn't that there aren't other perfectly fine architectures, but that they don't have floating point. And my experience on the IPAC was that if you want your multimedia code to work, there's a floating point in too many applications, and we wanted our apps to just work. So that drove the choice of that. So a year ago, there was the closest thing you could come on a different architecture to a reasonably integrated chip was a PowerPC chip that unfortunately had gigabit Ethernet also included, which would suck a lot of power. So we have three USB slots, SD, and so on and so forth, and half a gigabyte of flash, courtesy of Dave Woodhouse's log file system, which we're pushing about to its limits at half a gigabyte, but it is usable at this point. If you aren't storing already compressed content, it gets you about a factor of two in practice. There's the gamepad, the keyboard sealed, keep water and dirt out, and there's a novel pointing device. It either functions as a conventional touchpad in the center third, or something you can write with a stylophone. Kids currently are often writing in the dirt to practice their writing. Paper is too expensive, so how do you learn how to write? Obviously, you want an internal microphone, so it's always there. I've already mentioned the sensor mode on that. There's also a VGA resolution camera, which some of you have seen by wandering around. Jonathan Corbett actually wrote the driver for us. Jonathan's in the audience. Thank you. The power system design, power is unreliable and poor quality. So this thing will take anything from about 10 volts to 24 volts, which means you can plug it into a car battery or a truck battery, and you can plug it in backwards and the machine won't blow up. So almost anything you have at hand. We're using nickel metal hydride batteries and derating them, their capacity, and we think we'll get about 2,000 battery cycles. And it's a generator under development, actually a number of different ones. There's a crank, which is sort of a shear thing, This is a device, it's a pull cord device that gets your big muscles involved. You can attach it to a table and use your legs. If they can get the electronics to work on this guy properly, this looks to be a much more efficient device for generating power. I think it's a matter of time rather than if, but so far the problem is a strong person can get the voltage too high. They're having to make it a lot more robust electrically than they thought they were going to have to. So the LCD display is new and novel and has different characteristics than you're used to, which get us a lot of what we need. It's a 7.5-inch TFT LCD, 1200 by 900 resolution. That works out to 200 dpi exactly on this display. It has two modes, transmissive or reflective. In reflective, it's monochrome. And it has this very interesting diagonal pixel structure. So rather than having three subpixels, the pixels themselves have different colors. So it's a little bit lower resolution when running in color mode. It's hard to describe exactly what effect that has. The easiest thing to say is it's very honest. Is we've taken resolution charts, sort of standard photographic way of measuring resolution. So it's in the neighborhood of 800 by 600 in color, but it's a funny situation because the resolution, you actually have spatial resolution at all pixels potentially. And as the ambient light goes up and you get more reflected light, the resolution improves. Okay, so how do we get to lower the power? We want to be able to turn off the CPU and obviously not turn off the RAM, but get everything just saved to RAM. So usually inside of a laptop you find what's called a TCON chip. We thought, oh, we can put a little bit of memory there and then we can turn off the CPU. So the DCON chip is what lets us do this. This is where we started with the GIO directly driving the TFT. And this is what we ended up with, is the DCON has a megabyte of RAM, which is just enough to store 6 bits per pixel for all the pixels on the screen. If you work out the numbers carefully and pack the things in. And it drives the LCD, and that's how we get to that. So then we can suspend to RAM the processor whenever we want. And then there's the slippery slope. We flip down. The problem was that we built our first board, and the geode, we thought we had sort of closed off what our design was going to be. We discovered that the geode's integrated flash controller, how to put it, sucked rocks. We were getting like 3 megabytes a second out of it. Your typical disk drive on your laptop's in the neighborhood of 20, so you know, it's going to be pretty grim if we had to live with that. And of course, we'd always wanted a camera in the machine. And it turns out sensors aren't very expensive if you have some way to plug them in. Okay. And the countries were asking us for storage expansion. So obviously, well, maybe we ought to put an SD in. So we ended up, Marvell was willing to build us a chip. It's called Cafe. And it's the camera and flash enabler, quote unquote. And so it has basically three devices in it, which is a NAND flash controller, an SD controller, and the camera interface. In it, so you can do ASICs in something like 5 or 6 months, as opposed to fully custom stuff, which takes 2 or 3 years. But depending upon the farmers and what you're trying to grow, it can take different amounts of time. Okay, so Mary Lou Jepson, our CTO, who's one of the world's experts at display technology, spent 10 months trying to find any manufacturer willing to even do anything in the way of a new display, even one that turns out that the display people are more conservative than you can possibly imagine. This is part of why it's taken so long for flat panels to come into mass production. They just have conservatism that's amazing. But Chi Mei was kind of, we actually took a gamble with us. Well, there, by the way, is a picture of a school out of doors. We really mean what we say about having to be able to use these things out of doors. So Mary Lou understood that The TFT piece of a flat panel is actually the cheapest, is actually only about less than a third of the cost of a completed panel. The backlights where most and the color filters are where most of the cost is. So we're using LEDs for a backlight, which means that rather than having a high voltage power supply and a fluorescent light bulb, which are failure prone and expensive, how many people here have had their screens go sort of black? I know I have. Okay, so that kind of thing shouldn't happen here. So rather than 6 to 8 watts, our display takes 1 watt when running in color mode. In reflective grayscale, a 25 hertz refresh, this display consumes 100 milliwatts. Okay, so this is fundamentally interesting, and we can therefore want to be able to read with the processor off. This really changes what matters in terms of what the power consumption is. People are very sloppy in a lot of places right now because who can notice when the processor is idling away at, you know, 3 or 5 watts and your display is taking, you know, another 6 or 8 or 10 watts. You know, you just don't notice this stuff. So this is really going to change the industry in a pretty big way. And it doesn't require new processes by the TFT manufacturers, it turns out. So we can build this in high volume today. As soon as the display is not our pacing item at all. So this is an example. That's Mary Lou Jepson with one of our displays in bright sunlight with another. I guess that's an IBM, whatever, and you can't see the screen. We all know that's the way the world is, right? So this is not, yeah. That's Scott Sung, who's one of the principals in Chimay. So we're looking at having something that's able to be a book replacement. So not only is this sort of a laptop device, but it's also an ebook sort of device. And the resolution is a 200 dpi, okay? And this is about the size of a book. So should be pretty good. Or it is very good, actually, since we know. I'm not going to say should, because these things work and you can go look at yourself. So I've already talked about resolution. I'll run through the industrial design stuff. Industrial design is a set of compromises. We care lots of things about robustness. So, for example, the plastic's 50% thicker than you'd usually find. We really wanted to put rubber bumpers around it to help with shock when it drops, but so far we've been unable to get the right material. We're still trying to find that. And you iterate till done. The upper left-hand one was the iconic one with the crank built in as opposed to the external power supply that I've talked about. This is just a subset of the industrial design models that were made along the way as we explored the design space of which resulted in the guy here. So in November, the first early prototypes came off the line. That's what you're seeing around here. This is Quanta Computer in Shanghai, who are the largest manufacturers of laptops in the world. They build one-third of the laptops. Specifically, one-third of the machines in this room were manufactured outside of Shanghai in Quanta. They're what's called an ODM, who manufacture on behalf of HP and Apple and Dell and you name it. So that's sort of the finished machine. This is running machines. Early machines usually don't escape the lab. So what you're seeing right now is a machine that's less mature than what you'd normally get, in part because we want people like you to be able to help them a lot sooner. So, as all of you may know who've been working on it with us, thank you all, we've had a real problem with the touchpad working, the stylus part of the touchpad working properly due to noise problems. That was a big one. The buttons have various problems. The screen doesn't tilt back as far enough. We're working on making it stronger. You know, we want it to survive being dropped from a meter height onto rock, right? So. Things like that. So there's a lot of fixes in the build in the process of starting right now. They may actually do the surface mount of the boards on Friday if we stay on schedule for that build and the revised schedule in this build. And the pacing about when we could do this build turned out to be the touchpad. You just can't build something so you can actually physically get it, right? Yeah, the ingredients are really key. A lot of interesting stuff about the mechanical design, which I know very little about. Things like the LCD are shock mounted, that sort of thing. So it's some people ask us about environmental issues. Books are made out of paper, which takes lots of water, not to mention trees. How this really nets out, because so do integrated circuits take a lot of stuff as well over the life of the machines. Interesting question. I don't know what we're hoping to find somebody to actually do interesting environmental studies. But at least our machine is being designed in a way to, we hope it'll last about 5 years, including the batteries, and be recyclable, all that sort of stuff. Okay. Well, let's move on more toward the software. It's appropriate to appropriate. Fundamental pedagogical point of view we have is that you ought to be able to understand how computers work. Boy, isn't that a novel concept? People in this room usually actually understand how computers work. So we want everybody in the world to be able to do this sort of stuff, and not just for the software, but also for the content, the books. Look at Wikipedia. Isn't that an amazing thing? Okay? We want people all over the world to be able to contribute that sort of thing in all the languages of the world. There are 347 languages with more than 1 million speakers, according to Ethnologue. If you think we can deal with localization at that scale yet, you need to go help, because you're wrong. We obviously have to worry about software bloat. It's pretty easy to strip down a Linux distribution to something pretty small without much effort. We currently have sort of a base system that's in the 100 megabyte sort of range. We worried quite a bit about how to make it possible to secure the firmware, because I don't like losing sleep at night about somebody writing a virus. Even though viruses are harder to do on Linux than they are onto Windows, they have been known to happen, and I don't want some kook turning all of our machines into very pretty colored building bricks. Wouldn't be nice. So we thought we were going to use Linux as bootloader. In fact, we had that all running when Sun, much without any ado, without taking any credit for it, as part of the Open Solaris release, actually opened up open firmware at long last. So it's now actually open. The spec has been open for years because it actually was an IEEE standard. This is commonly used on PowerPCs and other architectures. Then, of course, we're running Linux and the Sugar user environment. Chris Blizzard is giving a tutorial about that tomorrow. Having the firmware means we have complete control. The commercial firmware we were first playing with on this machine did nothing for 20 seconds after power on. God only knows why, before it would do anything. So we also care that kids can actually learn how computers really work from the point that they actually power on. So this machine is that level of transparency. These are sort of some of the basic apps we're worrying about. We're the center of the kids we're trying to serve are the young kids. They may not know how to read yet. So we care a lot about a user interface. You know, our current user interfaces are for office workers and programmers who are adults primarily. So we are doing a new user interface, and it has some interesting characteristics. I do encourage you to go to Chris's tutorial about it. Most apps can run in that environment without too much trouble. It's basically sort of a GNOME stack of stuff for our base technology. We're using Python to pull it all together. Right now, performance is bad because Python startup is terrible, but we know ways to fix that. The fundamentally new thing, from my point of view, is using presence, which is to say, we want to have the kids know what kids are accessible to them and or their teachers, so they can work together. And we're reflecting that all the way back up into the user interface as a principal major thing, because we want the kids be able to collaborate end-to-end. And when I say end-to-end, I mean from the end of one end of the world to the other end of the world. Okay? If we want the kids to be able to learn from other kids in other countries, what better way to learn English or if you're in the United States, learn Swahili by somebody who actually knows how to speak the language properly. In all of China, where there are several hundred million people currently studying English, there's only a few hundred teachers who are native speakers of English. If you wonder why the Chinese have problems with spoken English, it's primarily that most of them have never heard it in a serious way and had a chance to practice it. So there's this idea of a Zoom interface where it shows different levels of things from what your own application, your own machine is doing to your buddies to the overall mesh. And you can see positioned together, oh, there's a bunch of people. Do we have a pointer thing here? Working together on some sort of a painting application. Right? So we really want the applications to let us show this. So it's very much using all the Avahi, or as it is Avahi, I never can remember how we were supposed to pronounce it. Let's see. Oops, wrong way around. Okay. So this is showing the individual machine with the different applications. This is where some of the application icons are. This is showing different activities where multiple people are collaborating together, and you can see that and decide to join in on them, that sort of thing. This is sort of a mock-up of an application. We're also working on a journal where the kids' work will be kept. We don't really want to have to expose the file system to a six-year-old, but any of you who have kids, how many of you of your kids get to keep a journal all the time and write? It's sort of fundamental. Certainly my kids, when they were learning to write, were keeping a journal on a daily basis, a nearly daily basis. So one of the things that's interesting about open source software is not only can you see the inside of it, but we're able to actually take advantage that there's often lots of competition among projects. If you have a big, slow, and power-hungry application, we just can't use it. So OpenOffice, which is meant for adult office workers, is big and bloated. Doesn't matter. 7-year-old, 8-year-old, 9-year-old, 11-year-old, 12-year-old, 15-year-old doesn't need that. Okay? AbbeyWord, on the other hand, is a nice small thing. It even starts up in finite time. So we often have many choices for any given tool. Small is beautiful. Simple is beautiful. Open-ended is beautiful, by which I mean things should be easy to start with, but you should be able to go indefinitely with it. So the TamTam music application, it's intended that you'd be able to just start pounding on keys and have it make nice music sorts of things. But then it's also being designed so that you can then compose riffs and rearrange and share them with your friends and go in and edit how the musical notes get processed in a thing that just appeared in the latest version of TamTam for doing the signal processing involved in, do you want that thing to have reverb or not, that sort of thing. And then, in fact, ultimately to making new sounds by being able to program the underlying P-Sound music synthesis system. So applications where there is no upper bound is also a huge to us. And the best example of that kind of design philosophy, I think, is TamTam, though it's not finished. You can see some of the glimmers of it on what's on these machines right now. See them around here. There's tons of ways you can help. And in your own self-interest, almost all of the work that needs to be done for OLTC will make your own machines work better. Okay? Remember what Andy was saying this morning. We have lots of bloatware. Let's get rid of bloatware. Please help with memory usage and leaks. There's lots of kernel work to do on power management, out-of-memory behavior. We really don't want to try to swap onto Flash. It isn't so much performance. It's just that we have better things to do with our flash. Localization is going to be a big issue. Not to about the next year, where we may only have 10 or 15 languages that we really care about, and since we have 60 or 70 already, that won't be an issue. But in about 18 months to 2 years, sometime go look at Ethnologue and see how many languages are spoken in, say, Pakistan is probably somewhere in between. It has quite a few languages. I don't know, 20 or 30. It only has 4 or 5 languages with more than 10 million speakers, some of which we have support for and a few of which we don't. There's things like Firefox which need to get fixed. We're all aware of this. Many of you saw Federico's wonderful blog over a year ago, which the Mozilla folks ignored for about 6 months and then realized they had a real problem. And so they're actually now making some real progress at fixing some of the memory losses in Firefox for good. Another point I want to make on all of this is think of servers as an optimization rather than being necessary for something to run. We want end-to-end applications. You should be able to work together immediately without having to rely on something you can't get to. Like about half the time now, I'm not able to get to my mail from here. God only knows why, because it's halfway around the planet. That sort of thing. So a lot of this stuff is now within our grasp technologically. So in any case, here's where we are. We're down in here. We're about to make our second developer or build about 2,500 machines. There'll be a third beta test build and then a C test build before sometime this summer we go into high volume mass production. We have to start getting really moving on the server side of this. If you know anybody who's interested in leading the work for the school servers, I'd like to talk to you. That should be a very interesting job. So thank you. I would like to thank you all. Okay. Is time for any questions? Or
yep, I think we've got time for one or two quick questions. We start down here. We just get a microphone too.
What do you think about Bill Gates' comment that this is sort of like a toy machine and it doesn't make sense for kids to just be cranking it all day? They should get a real computer instead.
Bill, welcome to his opinion, and that leaves a majority of the world's kids out in the dark, which is where they live, by the way.
Could we just pass the microphone down so we can...
Does the standard software build on the devices include the tool chain and source code? And if not, how do we avoid turning people into passive consumers of software?
I couldn't quite catch the second half of that.
And if it's not there, aren't we putting kids in the position of being passive consumers of software?
No. Our point of view is that for the younger kids, giving them a C compiler is the wrong thing to do first. So. Python is there, JavaScript is there on day one, Logo is there, though we don't have it in the current build. It will be very shortly. Those are the much more appropriate ways to start teaching programming than inflicting C or C++ on some 8-year-old or 10-year-old or 12-year-old. Let's walk before we can run or stumble in the case of C. I would never say that. I would never accuse you of running, right? It's a great high-level assembly language. It really is. Dennis did a wonderful job at that, but that's what it is.
Okay, one more question out the back.
So this might be a little bit provocative. I think if we can make this work, or you can make this work, and we can get the kids back to use it, it's absolutely wonderful.
However, we need to make this work.
Right, but...
I can't make this work alone.
No, but what I'm saying with it is, if we look at a lot of the aid projects that have been done in places like Africa, and a lot of the countries which you're targeting where there's effectively no light in the schools and the kids are barely allowed to go to school, there's been a lot of cases were, I mean, Europe has been really big on putting money into Africa. And if you today go back and look at the money that we've spent over the last 30 years, a lot of it's actually gone into, unfortunately, into projects that as soon as people pull out, they're abandoned, like pumping stations, sometimes the schools are not, you know, being abandoned later. And if we give this fancy, flashy device to the kids in Africa, are they actually going to be allowed to use it for their parents? Are they going to have the time to do it? Are they going to, you know, what's going to happen? Are they going to start selling them on the sort of black market to try and get a little bit of money? So I guess my question here is it really worthwhile, or are we trying to target the right horse to fix the problem? Because if we can get the kids up to speed in IT, I think that's wonderful, but I'm not personally convinced that's the first thing we need to fix.
To begin with, our intent is that these machines get directly to the kids as opposed to the schools. So the schools have a central role to play in all of this, obviously.
But in that one there, one of the things that's often been seen is that the kids are not even being allowed to go to school for their parents because they have to work.
It depends where you are. I mean, there's clearly places where it's going to be really tough. There's a wonderful book, by the way. I recommend all of you read it. It was a New York Times bestseller, believe it or not. And I find it very amazing that I ever recommend anybody read something on a bestseller list. But it's a book called Three Cups of Tea by Greg Mortensen, and a guy who actually did most of the writing part of it, whose name slips my mind at the moment, about what Greg has done in northern Pakistan and what the kids there go through and their families are willing to do to get them the tools to learn with, okay? I mean, including schools, which Mortensen's organization that has now built about, approaching 60 of. I don't want to be flip, but you're asking a great question. It's a very long discussion that I think we ought to take offline. But I wanted to make a plug for his book because it was really a wonderful thing. It gave me a lot of perspective on what it's like in at least one of the poorest places in Pakistan, which is northern Pakistan, literally up against the Karakoram Mountains, or in the Karakoram Mountains, next to K2. And he stumbled into it, having failed at his and stumbled into a village after failing to climb K2, and his life changed.
You're saying that Sun has open source over here, sorry.
To answer a specific one of your questions, I think we actually have a show source key on somebody's question. We have a show source key, which the intent is that we actually have it get you to the source code for what you're running. We think it's worth having a key on the keyboard which does that. And by the way, there's no caps lock key. Control's in its right place.
You're saying that Sun has open sourced some of their hardware. What other companies have really proactively gone out of their way to help you with creating this?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch that.
You're saying that Sun open sourced some of their firmware. What other companies have proactively gone out of their way to help you in ways that you haven't really chased them and asked for, sort of thing?
Lots of the companies involved have done really amazing things for us. I know there's been some controversy about the firmware for the Marvell Wireless. We're still talking with them about that. We'll see if we can get it out in a serious way. I can't yet make a promise, but it's all I can say that we have not let that drop. The specs for the CAFE chip are being released. They have a tech writer working on the documents right now for that piece of the system. The firmware is open firmware in Linux BIOS, so all that code is out there. So, you know, there are a couple little pieces which aren't open source, but almost everything is. The ironic thing is the very few pieces which haven't been have also been some of the most painful things to fix along the way, as David Woodhouse can tell you some war stories of what it's been like to get the wireless module to work. source code matters, so no surprise to us, but I'm certainly learning about how vital it is even in the hardware game.
Okay, well, I think we shall thank Jim for his wonderful presentation.